Welcome to a global edition of Bike Talk. Today we'll have a conference call with bike advocates from the European Cycling Federation, Portland's Bicycle Transportation Alliance, and Chicago's Active Transportation Alliance, with city bike coordinators from Portland and Memphis, and someone from the Green Lane Project of Bikes Belong, which is helping American cities install protected bike lanes. We'll look at some of the barriers to biking in these cities and beyond, as well as some strategies for bike advocacy. With help as moderator is a local bike lane activist and small bike store owner, Joseph.
Yeah, my name is Joseph Bray Ali. I'm the founder of the Los Angeles Bike Oven, and I also own a small bike shop called the Flying Pigeon Bike Shop. It's based in Cypress Park in Los Angeles. So I've been involved in the bike scene in Los Angeles since towards the end of 2005 when I founded the Bike Oven. And most recently I've been involved in a big to-do in our neighborhood neighborhood council meetings with the local politicians involved with a bike lane going in on a street in front of my shop called North Figueroa Street. And it has been crazy. It has been wild. It's been a big adventure in modern 21st century insanity. So I had a couple questions I wanted to throw at some of these folks and see if they're sharing my opinion on them or because it's been a big struggle just emotionally and, I don't know. The politics seem like they might have been worked out. But anyway, I'll let Nick take it back over, and I've got a few questions for you guys later on.
All right. Well, let's start with Zach.
Okay, sure. My name is Zach Vandercoy, and I work with the Green Lane Project, which is a facilitated partnership of six cities that are our leaders in installing a particular urban innovation, a better bike lane or a protected bike lane. And we work with Portland and Memphis, who are on the call.
Okay, and Portland and Memphis. So Portland, we have Garrick from Bicycle Transportation Alliance. Hello, Garrick.
Hello. We're a 22-year-old nonprofit based in Portland, Oregon, and our work is focused on making bicycling more safe, convenient, and accessible. And we happen to work in one of the most bike-friendly cities in the country, with between 5% and 6% of people meeting their daily needs by bike.
Thank you, Garrick. And we also have Roger Geller, who is the bike coordinator of the City of Portland. Roger?
Yeah, good morning. I've been the bike coordinator with the city. I've been working on bicycling in the City of Portland since 1994. And my job really is about making sure that we achieve our policy goal, which is that 25% of all trips are made by bicycle by the year 2035.
Great. And do we have Kyle here?
Yeah, Kyle Wagenschutz from Memphis. I am the city's bicycle and pedestrian coordinator. And Memphis is a city that's only really been investing in bicycle infrastructure for the last 2 or 3 years. But we've been making humongous strides over that time.
Great. And another Green Lanes Project city is Chicago. Ethan?
Yes, hello. I work with the Active Transportation Alliance, and we're proud to be one of the Green Lane cities. It's very exciting, and we've been putting in a lot of new bicycling infrastructure over the past couple of years. And we're the Chicago region's bike, walk, and transit nonprofit with 7,000 members around the region, and we're just mobilizing people as much as possible to make it better and safer to bike, walk, and take transit.
Thank you, Ethan. And all the way from Brussels, we have Kevin Main, Development Director of the European Cycling Federation. Hello, Kevin.
Hello. I'm basically working for the Umbrella Federation for the advocacy movement in Europe. European Cyclists Federation is now 30 years old. It primarily exists to lobby at the international level and then to support what our 70 member associations in 40 different countries actually do at a local level for their local advocacy. And in our terms, that's everything from probably the biggest advocacy organization in the world in Germany with 120,000 members down to some lonely volunteers trying to hold together a tiny federation in somewhere in Eastern Europe. Many people on the panel also know us because we host the world's biggest cycling advocacy conference called Velo City, which this year saw 1,400 delegates in Vienna just talking cycling. So we're a fairly good clearinghouse for what's happening globally on cycling advocacy, infrastructure, city development.
Do we have a corresponding organization in the United States, Kevin?
Well, you've got three kind of national advocacy organizations in the kind of League of American Wheelmen, and you've got the Alliance for Cycling and Walking, and you've got Bikes Belong with its kind of industry programs, which obviously Zach is part of. I don't think you have, I guess between them they umbrella up most of it. I gather most of your, effective your city organizations are fairly independent. They can choose whether to federate into those associations or not. But I'm sure the other guys would have a clearer picture on that than I do.
Let me have Joseph do a little moderating here. And so do you know who everybody is?
Yeah. No, I did a little bit of reading last night, and I'm glad to meet you all this morning. Gentlemen, thank you so much. Listen, we have a national bunch of bike advocates on the air today, and an international group, in fact. And so this is something that has been eating away at me since I attended my first public hearing a few months ago on these Figueroa bike lanes in Los Angeles. I keep hearing from these old Tea Party types at public meetings about bike lanes the following things: that these bike lane advocates are either A, all in the pockets of developers, B, part of the UN Agenda 21, or C, some sort of useful idiots for the general globalist corporatist conspiracy. So, gentlemen, I want to ask you now, are any of you a member of the UN 21 Agenda 21 conspiracy? And if not, has this affected your advocacy efforts in the cities that you're working in? And I'd like to start, if I could, with Kevin from the European Cycling Federation, being that you are of such an international flavor here in this English language American.
I'm into 21 something from my background advocacy in the UK, that many very highly respected advocacy organisations have been part of and highly supportive of. So the idea that in general the UN is some kind of globalist conspiracy doesn't sit too well with us. And we have some very good partnerships with people like the World Health Organization, with UN Habitat, that is developing models to deal with the kind of globalization trends where cities will be 50% of the world's population as we go forward. So we're actually quite positive about some of those agendas and proud to be associated with them.
Any plans then that any gentlemen are aware of from the bike advocacy movement to herd people into UN camps, take away their cars at gunpoint, et cetera? These are things that I've heard in public meetings. And I was wondering, Zach, if you work, I guess, on a little bit more of a quasi-national level with a few different cities, with the Green Lanes Project and Bikes Belong. If you have heard these things mentioned in public hearings, if this is part of the issue, it seems like it comes from an older bunch. Whenever I go to public hearings, they're kind of grasping at straws, looking for something to oppose bike projects.
Well, even though we work at a national level, it really comes back to the point that every project is local. I think what you know, maybe some of these people at meetings are expressing is that it's a very emotional issue when it comes to changing how streets work. Comes to changing the way that space is allocated on streets, it affects people very personally and directly. So maybe that's more of a proxy for what they're expressing. But no plans to take away anyone's cars.
Guys, I'm sorry, what is the UN 21?
The UN Agenda 21, it was done in Rio de Janeiro. I had to read about this going back in time because I had no idea, working as a bike advocate for several years. Mm-hmm. In Rio de Janeiro, maybe 20, 25 years ago, there was one of these kind of like, the world should strive to, live a little more densely and stop polluting so much kind of things. And it's been pulled out by a lot of the sort of fringe right wingers that this is all a green conspiracy to stick us all inside of apartheid camps and take away our liberty, basically. Wow. But it is something real in terms of, at the public hearings I attend, it has been something that has popped its head up. People hold this book with a green skull on the front of it and say that I'm a paid stooge. And so I was wondering if we have any paid stooges on the line, if you'd please identify yourself. And anyway, okay, all right. I'll move on, guys. I'm sorry. I just had to talk about it. It's been something that's really surprised me, actually, at the local meetings. Here's something I wanted to ask. The two spike coordinators we have in both Memphis and in Portland, and I think we have some folks also from Active Trans in Chicago. I'm sure you've dealt with this in Chicago especially. In New York City now, there seems like several billionaires have fallen in love with bike lanes, two in particular, Mayor Michael Bloomberg and a gentleman who founded Streets Blog. I think his name is it Mark Gordon or Aaron Naparstek. Anyway, are bike lanes in your city looking like smart money investments for the city, you know, entering this age of widespread civic bankruptcy and austerity at the local government level? Do you think bike lanes help, hurt, or kind of do nothing for the basic economics of running the city? And then further, do you think it takes a billionaire in your town to kind of get behind bike lanes to really push for the protected and green lanes that seem like they're always out of reach in some cities? Like I know in Los Angeles, it's been a big fight. I don't know, Roger, I think you might have Roger Geller from Portland, the bike coordinator. I don't know if you have any insight into this.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So they certainly do help. And the other fellow from New York that you're thinking of is Mark Gorton.
There we go.
Who's been actively promoting the livable streets movement in New York and has been basically talking about it around the country. So, yeah, it absolutely does help, and I think it helps in a number of different ways. One of the themes that's sweeping urban America right now is that cities want to be desirable, and they especially want to be desirable to people who are talented, who are college-educated, who have a choice about where they want to live. And they provide kind of the human capital for cities. And one of the things that those people are looking for are livable cities, and they're looking for cities that are affordable. And so the less that they need to drive, the less that they have to have need for an automobile, the more attractive cities are. And so cities right now, Chicago, New York, L.A. to a certain extent, Portland, Memphis, all these cities are really competing to make their cities as livable as possible, and bicycle transportation has a huge role to play in that. We are seeing article upon article in both mainstream and bike media here in Portland about how developers and businesses are looking to site businesses in locations where their employees can bike and walk and take advantage of the urban environment. The other way that it really helps at a more macro level is most cities in the U.S. are not producing automobiles, are not mining oil out of the ground, and are not refining oil. So almost every penny that the citizens of those cities are spending on automobiles, either purchasing, repairing, or feeding to keep them moving, is money that is typically leaving those cities. And we had an economist from the Brookings Institute do a calculation. It's called Portland's Green Dividend. And he estimates that because residents of the Portland metropolitan region drive less than the national average, we are keeping $800 million annually in our local economy that would have otherwise left the region just if we drove it at the national average levels. So it's about attractiveness. It's about keeping money local. And also it's about keeping goods and things moving. The fewer cars there are on the roads, the easier it is for goods and material to move across the city. So those are some of the ways. You know, the health aspect is also huge in terms of employers' burdens for health care. And so, yes, it absolutely has a positive benefit for cities. And people like Bloomberg and Mark Gorton recognize this and are promoting it.
Okay. Kyle, now you're coming from a city that has just recently, thank you very much, Roger, by the way, Kyle Wagenschutz from the bike coordinator of Memphis. You're coming from a city that you said in 2 or 3 years has really picked up the ball on bike lanes. Seems like Memphis is one of those cities that's been through it all. You guys have your own pyramid, I understand, down by the waterfront and several other interesting.
We actually have a pyramid.
Okay. So the rumors are true.
Actually in downtown Memphis. And yeah, we've really as a city only really consciously been focusing on alternative modes of transportation for the last 2 or 3 years. That's largely due to a new wave of leadership that came into office here in the late 2000s. And I just want to echo everything that Roger mentioned in terms of what we're seeing here, effects that we're seeing here in Memphis mirror the same kinds of imagery and impacts that Roger mentioned. You know, but also for Memphis, the economics of bicycle facilities sort of reach further into our psyche, in that we aren't a cash rich city by any stretch of the means, and so we're constantly looking for ways to expand our services, our ability to impact our residents in a positive way, but also being mindful that we don't always have the money to impact those services. And so for instance, you know, we'd love to be able to serve more people with our public transit system, but the capital dollars just aren't there to purchase new buses, to expand our rail system. And so we're looking to bicycle facilities as a cost-effective alternative to expanding the reach of our transit services through better linkages, providing better information about how you can utilize the existing transit services with your bicycle. And so we're trying to, you know, match up compatible modes of transportation, match up compatible programs here as a city, just because we don't simply have the budget to continue to do all the things that we used to do over time. And I think also, you know, our business community is recognizing that. One of the curiosities here in Memphis is that this is the world headquarters for AutoZone, the used car part wholesaler throughout the country. And the founder and CEO of AutoZone, his philanthropic organization, is one of the largest benefactors to bicycle facilities throughout the city. And so there's this funny irony that
that's the guy
that's made millions off of selling car parts to people is now turning around and investing all of that money he's making in bicycle facilities here in Memphis.
Well, I guess if you're really anti-bike, then I guess we're going to have to boycott AutoZone now. Very confusing situation. That's very interesting. So I guess I'm going to have to find a way to go to AutoZone now and support them to help you guys out. Ethan Spots in Chicago, have you seen, now Chicago is well known as a rich town. You guys have got a lot of marketing, big executives, massive office buildings, all kinds of big business going on in that town. Have you seen any effect from the interest of billionaires in your bike lane advocacy? Is this the smart money bet for Chicago, or is this just kind of a whim of some crazy environmentalists?
Okay. Well, I haven't seen a lot of fallout from the rich aspects of Chicago. But yes, there are a couple of high-powered business people that are behind putting in protected bike lanes. And I think that's been helpful. It's obviously, it can't be the only solution. It's got to be one part of the mix. What we're seeing in Chicago is our newest mayor, Mayor Emanuel, put down in his transportation agenda that he wanted to install 100 miles of protected bike lanes. And, you know, we had a board member and a staff member on his transportation transition committee to help set that agenda, so we were able to be at the table when he was outlining his transportation agenda, which we think was really helpful. But he's also been incredibly supportive of moving people around, not just moving cars, but making sure that people, whether they're walking, biking, taking the train or the bus or driving, have a safe and efficient way to get around. Part of his goals in putting in 100 miles of protected bike lanes is specifically to bring in business. He wants businesses to move to Chicago, specifically technology firms like Grubhub and Google and Motorola Mobility have been targeted as supporters of this effort and supporters of Mayor Emanuel's goal of putting in protected bike lanes, because those are companies that are saying, yes, in order for us to get high-talented people in the technology sector to move to Chicago, we have to have safe and easy ways for people to bike. So the business aspect of supporting protected bike lanes and protected infrastructure is very important. We're doing advocacy work in our campaigns and outreach to target and get businesses to sign on to be bike-friendly businesses. So we do a lot of work with chambers of commerce and business associations and local businesses to ensure that there's support from the business community.
Very, very interesting, gentlemen. Thank you so much for your thoughts on that. There was something I wanted to ask some of the guys working on a little bit of these larger issues. Kevin from the European Cycling Federation and Garrick with the BTA. You guys have kind of got a little bit of a higher-up view on these things. I was wondering, and some of our city bike coordinators, you can sound in here as well if you'd like. Here in Los Angeles, we recently developed a map of the 50 deadliest intersections, which I loved. I've been advocating that for years. It's been a great political tool for us to, for all the local politicians to say, I have reduced crashes by so-and-so amount. I was wondering if your city or if your organization tracks measurements like the number of crashes per mile per year or simply the location and types of crashes. And if you don't do that, but do you use those types of metrics to lobby for bike lanes? Are there some key metrics that you've used in your campaigns? And maybe if you can think of something that really stood out as like a type of measurement, a style of measurement just to introduce the topic to everyone else, when I go to these public meetings, I'm always hammered by, it's going to increase travel times and car traffic will be horrible and the level of service will go down. The level of service is like a flow measurement for cars moving on the street. And so I found measurements to be a big part of combating that, an alternative set of measurements. And I was wondering if in Europe in particular, if there are any measurements that you guys have seen to be more or less effective in your advocacy, if it's kind of not part of the whole issue. And if we can hear from some of the other folks after that, it'd be great. Kevin?
Yeah, I mean, we basically headline two figures. One is, you know, share of transport for cycling. It's a universal figure. Every city should measure it. Every country should measure it. It's a bit tricky that everybody measures it in a slightly different way, and it's not always a perfect tool, but you have the very simplistic, is cycling going up? So, I mean, and it's also very important to talk about it in terms of share, because it also talks about, you know, what other modes and what are other elements doing. And I think just for an interesting one for all of you guys to think about for a moment, when you think, you know, great European cycling countries, most people go, you know, you guys have got Holland. And then everybody goes, yeah, but it's okay, they're a bit weird, they're Dutch.
Yeah, yeah.
Interestingly, the Dutch drive nearly as much as everybody else in Europe. Pause for thought. Well, what's missing? Well, the missing is actually things like bus and public transport use tend to be lower. The bicycle replaces those shorter journeys within towns and cities. The Dutch have got fabulous car infrastructure, and they drive a lot, and they drive into work, in fact, almost as far as anybody in Europe. Huh. So they are designing extremely good streetscapes for driving, as well as designing extremely good streets for bicycling. And they integrate those, and it works. Now, it to some extent works because they smoothed out car float. So cars don't go as fast, and they don't go as slow. So there's lots of 20-mile-an-hour zones. There's lots of slow-speed areas. So we're really, you can see those flows and car flows being integrated with bicycling or walking, and see, but there is an overall understanding that the car is sharing space and time and transit with particularly cycling in this case. The other measure that we measure is kind of casualty rates, which is followed through right across Europe. The best measure we find, however, is to measure those rates against kind of the level of cycling, because you actually know, if you take raw numbers, the most dangerous place in Europe to be a cyclist is the Netherlands. Well, actually,
really?
It's not true, because they're just, if you take a raw statistic about what percentage of the Dutch population is involved in a cycling accident, it seems like a lot of them are.
Right.
But, of course, it's against a massive proportion of cyclists that go forward. And the big deal is not absolute casualties. The big deal is cycling going up? Are we getting the raw numbers of cyclists through our system? Because if you double and treble and quadruple your levels of cycling, if you're just held to account as a city manager as to whether there were more cycling accidents or not, you will never succeed.
Right.
You're on a hiding to nothing. So,
as the number of cyclists go up,
then people to look at cycling exposure. Obviously, you want to drive down casualties and fatalities, but the thing that matters more than anything else is to be ferociously driving up your levels of cycling. And when you're looking at your investments and at your junctions, you are saying not, are there a lot of casualties at the junction? You're saying, does this junction stop people cycling? So if this junction cuts off a community from a park, which is a good cycling destination for families, then deal with it. But don't just make it entirely casualty-driven. You should be focusing on fixing that junction. Will it help more people cycle? Yes, right. Then it's a positive investment, not a negative investment, because we're dealing with something that actually is, you know, a kind of horrible place to be.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, no, I've seen this at work in local meetings. It seems like in the States, at least in Los Angeles, pointing out that so-and-so number of people have died on this intersection has seemed like sometimes the only way to get something moved forward. when it comes to safety improvements, or in this case, with the bicycle improvements. I was wondering if one of the folks with our more meta-level organizations, if Zach Venter-Coy or if Garrick with the BTA, if you guys had any thoughts on the metrics that you guys are using in your advocacy efforts?
Well, I have a few thoughts on metrics. This is Zach. One of the things that we do with the Green Lane Project is create opportunities for our American city professionals to interact with their peers in some of the more advanced European countries, so the Netherlands and Denmark. And this is it really is a two-way exchange, but one of the things that we're taking back from places like Copenhagen that have a very high level of bike use is the way that they measure. And in Copenhagen, there's basically three things that they're looking at. It's how many people are riding, it's how safe is it, and how much do people like it.
How many people like it?
Equally important. Yeah, how much do people like it? Do they perceive it to be safe? Do they perceive it to be convenient? So they do very robust qualitative surveys of their population, asking them, do you like this? How is this system working for you?
And how does that work exactly?
Driving a car or riding a bike, yeah. And we tend to be very focused on safety, and that's a good thing, and we need to make all of our streets safer for everyone. But I think we're evolving to the point where we're starting to bring in a little bit more of these qualitative measurements and evaluating the success not only on how safe it is, but how safe do people feel when they're using it, and do people use it?
It's interesting. You know, I never heard, in the States, it always seems like such traffic is always treated as this very mechanistic system. I never heard anybody in the profession of planning or the transportation engineering say, you know, let's ask these folks if they're happy doing this, if they enjoy it. That's a great idea from Copenhagen. No wonder you guys are seeing some success.
Just to chip in, it's Kevin again.
Yes.
If you go back to quality of life as the driver for your city mayors, for your economic model for your city, there's nothing else you should be measuring. And that is where we've seen a significant shift, I think, in political attitudes with this kind of global competition between cities. So I think what you're saying is Copenhagen actually reflecting the tip of a very big movement. It is qualitative elements that make the difference. And don't forget, happy people vote for the existing mayor.
Yeah. That is a really great point. Yeah.
This is Roger here. Just to add to that, I think what Zach's referring to is a document that the city of Copenhagen puts out every couple of years called their bicycle account, where they track those kind of things. And they just put out, or I just saw the one from 2012, and they've got this great quote that I'm using now. And the quote is that the significant increase in the feeling of safety is primarily linked to improvements in infrastructure, such as better intersections, wider cycle tracks, et cetera. So what's interesting about that is they're talking about not safety itself, but about the feeling of safety. And they've identified that it is that feeling of safety that is important in encouraging people to go out and ride a bicycle. And the more people that ride, actually, there's also this safety in numbers phenomena. The more people they get riding, the safer it becomes.
You guys, thank you very much. To bring up a very interesting point that I have thus far not seen on the scene here in Los Angeles, and that would be the actual asking of people on the streets how they feel about their city. I think that'd be revolutionary in a lot of American towns. So and I'm sure in some parts of Europe as well. So I don't want to belabor that point any further. I did have another question, and I don't know if this is going to strike you guys as a little bit off kilter here. Seeing as this, I'm going to start it this way. So my credit union, I just went in to make a deposit. My credit union here in Los Angeles is offering to qualified buyers, of course, an auto loan for between 2-4%. And it begs a question. I own a bike shop, and I wondered, why is there no financing available for small businesses and especially the middle and lower class working families to equip themselves with the types of bikes, the number of bikes they need to stop driving? Credit card debt, if you wanted to just say, well, they can finance it themselves, for most of these families starts at around 15 to 17%, and especially for, you know, small business, just using a signature loan, an unsecured loan. I know this is something that a lot of advocacy organizations I've met with don't really have a good pinpoint on. I was wondering if you guys could help answer, you know, why is this financing bit of cycling such an ignored part of advocacy for bikes when it seems like that's one of the biggest gaps I see in my working class neighborhood when it comes to cycling, is that we've got these big cargo bikes, we've got these Yuba Mundos, extra cycles. Businesses would, in the downtown, newly refurbishing downtowns, would love to have some kind of delivery bikes, but I always see them riding on a cheap department store bike with a really terrible milk crate lashed to the front, and I think, man, it wouldn't take much to get these folks a small loan, a microcredit loan, to get the proper bikes. I was wondering if any of you have had any experience with this sort of movement, or if you think it's a blind spot, or if it even is even worth paying attention to. Any of the bike coordinators from our cities in Memphis or Portland, or Garrick with the BTA in Portland, if you guys have anything you'd like to add to that? You guys can jump
go ahead,
in.
Garrick. I have a vague, this is Roger, I have a vague recollection of some loans that were available for people to buy bicycle, but it's pretty vague.
Okay. So does this seem something that's very essential? Garrick, I don't know if you have done anything like this with the BTA in Portland, if you have kind of been the middleman between financiers and cyclists to help help people get these work bikes in their lives.
No, we certainly haven't, but I'll take the occasion to reference some research that was done by actually one of our partner organizations here in Portland. The Community Cycling Center in 2009 conducted a fairly significant bit of research to help understand the barriers to bicycling, and in fact they came up with access to bikes as one of those barriers. They identified, all kinds of other concerns about getting low-income communities connected to the bicycle as a daily means of transportation, but one of them was access to the bike. So you've got your finger on the pulse of a relevant problem, but I can't say that I've spent much time on the advocacy side working on the solution.
Well, it seems like we might have to talk to some of those aforementioned billionaires. Maybe they can set up the Grameen Bike Bank
in
Los
Angeles.
Yes, go ahead. And this is
perspective, because I mean, the big movement, to some extent, has come from the U.S., but it's been fairly, it's the kind of bike kitchens type approach, where community recycling is a big deal. I mean, here in Brussels, there's a massive community cooperative now with 5-6 stores that is taking bicycles off the street from the city and from the police, putting them back on the street, but also offering training and employment to unemployed people to work in the workshops. So that whole scheme is a very big deal across much of Europe. But I have to say, put it in context, in some of these places, it's because we're now reaching the next 5 to 10% of the community who we want to get cycling.
Yeah.
If you guys are talking about cities where you're talking about 1%, please don't tell me there's not another 1% of the community who can't afford a bike. your significant return, and if the possibility is there's a nice middle-class neighborhood that would leave their cars and start cycling, and that's going to give you another 1,000 cyclists, frankly, you start there. You start worrying about the poorer neighborhoods or the other. Doesn't sound very egalitarian, and I wouldn't like the Tea Party much because I don't sound like a communist. But ruthlessly, you've got to know where the next 5,000 cyclists, 10,000 cyclists, 20,000 cyclists are going to come from. If it's going to come from a university campus, then you focus on the university campus, and maybe you put in bike share, or maybe you put in cheap bikes. But I think you can get awfully distracted by the idea that access to bikes is an issue in surveys. You can get awfully distracted by other things in surveys that people say, I wouldn't do this. And, we know there's 20 or 30% of the population who say, you could start World War III and I wouldn't leave my car.
This is true.
You have to ask the positive question, what would get the next 1,000 people, the next 5,000 people, the next 10,000 people? And I personally have seen very little evidence, my background being in the UK, where we have historically very low cycling levels like the US, access to bikes is not the issue until you've got substantive cycling levels.
Okay.
We've got to go where the easy people are first.
So start, I guess that would be a great point.
And I would just echo those thoughts wholeheartedly. Prior to my position with the city, I actually was the director of a community bicycle recyclery here in Memphis called Revolutions. And we've been in existence for about 10 years now. And I just say that sort of played out here, where for so long we were focused on helping people get bicycles, helping them provide them with bicycles to the tune of, you know, we've over 10 years, Revolutions has put about 5,000 bicycles back out onto the streets of Memphis. It wasn't until the city began to make conscious investments in building infrastructure that we actually saw the numbers of cyclists increasing. So over 2 years, Memphis has added 50 miles of new bike lanes, and we've seen cycling levels rise by 400% here in the city. And so that's exactly, you know, our mindset right now is we're focused on capturing everybody that we know has bicycles sitting in their garage right now, while also supporting those organizations that continue to reach out to persons that don't have access.
Well, thank you guys very much. That's been something burning through my mind as I've been trying to start a cargo bike business here in Los Angeles out of my shop and not having very much success. I'll just have to wait for those bike lanes to go in. And it sounds like other bike shops around the country would do wise to shift their efforts in that direction. There was one thing I wanted to bring up, guys, and I know we're going to get a little close on time here. And that is coalitions. When I think about bikes these days, I don't really think about bikes. I usually think about Los Angeles's burned out streetcar suburbs making a comeback. And I see bike allies in local merchant or property owner groups looking to either cash out with their building or find some new tenants to pay a nice high rent. Now that can also be a problem with, you know, residential rental rates. But nonetheless, those folks sometimes aren't very quite interested in bike lanes. I also see money and support coming from large healthcare and insurance interests. Who are your big allies in your struggle for change that I would say are not involved directly in the bike community but have definitely found some purchase with you? And I don't know if anyone at the Active Transit Alliance in Chicago might be. Ethan, if you've got any insight into that?
That's a great question. We're not really seeing, you know, we look at we just launched our Department of Transportation, launched a large-scale bike share program, which we're very excited about. We've been pushing for a robust, large-scale bike sharing program for years, and it's here. And the funding is coming from federal sources, I believe $22 million to launch this bike sharing. And it's making a difference already in just a couple of months. But we look at Minneapolis, Blue Cross, Blue Shield, you know, you said health, the health arena. They helped fund and start bike sharing in Minneapolis, and that was great. Just in Chicago, we're not really seeing that. A lot of the money that is coming for the protected bike lanes or the cycling infrastructure that we're seeing is coming from our from CDOT, from the sources that they get, either through federal money and safety and environmental, from CMAQ and from other transportation enhancements programs, and also local money from chambers of commerce and business associations. We have a lot of chambers of commerce and business associations around the city who are investing in bike racks, bike corrals, digital transit readouts. So if you're in a cafe or a shop in a particular neighborhood, you can get the digital readout of the next three buses or trains that will be coming by. So we're seeing a lot of that. And then also support from local councilmen or aldermen, as we call them in Chicago. So each alderman has $1.3 million in infrastructure money that they can spend to improve their ward. And some of our wards, about five of our wards, are doing participatory budgeting where people in the wards are determining how that money is spent. And we're seeing that when people are given the choice on how they want that money to be spent, a lot of it is going to bicycle and pedestrian projects or making sure that streets and intersections are safe. So that's really where the money is. We're seeing our Department of Transportation, we're installing protected bike lanes, but they're doing it in a very efficient and economical manner. We're not doing full barriers with concrete. We're using plastic bollards to create that barrier, and that's working, and we're able to install. I mean, we went from 0 to 30 miles of protected and buffered bike lanes in 2 years.
Garrick, yeah, with the BT. Garrick. Sorry, yeah. I was wondering if you had any coalitions outside of cycling that you guys have worked with in your efforts at the state level and at the local level.
Well, we're finding more and more that every project we work on, the success of that project rises or falls based on the size of the coalition that we're able to bring to the campaign. So our partnerships, both inside and outside the sort of transportation sphere, are becoming one of the most important things we've got to do. You know, we know that every time we work on a project, we've got a few key areas we focus on: community support, political support, funding, and then planning and design. But the community support comes first, and, you know, our story around bringing bike share to the city of Portland, which should be on the ground next summer, is a similar one to the one that Ethan tells from Chicago, and that is, you know, broad-based support from leaders in the health community, the business community, and other neighborhood associations. Thousands of people basically standing up and saying that this is a good idea. We want to bring bike share to Portland, and that's the political dynamic that makes it desirable for elected leaders to say, okay, we can dedicate some funding to this. So working with Kaiser Permanente, which is a healthcare provider, as a potential sponsor of our bike share system, as well as a prominent sponsor for one of our open streets initiatives we call Sunday Parkways, where we open up our streets a handful of times each summer to allow anywhere between 15 and 20,000 people to come out and bring their families and ride their bikes and walk on the streets that are closed to automobiles but open for everyone else. And that Kaiser Permanente sees that as a valuable point to get their message across. And it's been a sort of a game changer for our city. So we're doing similar work to what Ethan described in Chicago about bringing the downtown Chamber of Commerce on board so that we can dispel some of those crazy notions that we started today's podcast on, talking about that radical liberal agenda.
Right, right.
In fact, this stuff is based on personal relationships, and if we can build those relationships with business leaders, find the points of common interest, and then build our campaigns around that common interest, we don't have opponents, we have more allies, and that's how we're able to win our campaigns.
Now, guys, I know this is not the happiest note to end this on, but I wanted to ask it anyway, and it's something that has been really interesting to me. In my fight for the bike lanes on North Figueroa, I was hammered by a local newspaper man who runs kind of like just a little, you know, the girls' softball team at this junior high school did a great job kind of newspaper. And he decided to go to war against bike riders. He printed all kinds of lies, fabulous lies about who we were and what we were interested in. And I was wondering who your biggest opponents are, if they are opponents in fact, or if they just kind of find themselves there because you have marched into their territory or their psychological or political sphere. Do you think it's just cultural inertia that's fighting against bike lanes in your city or town or in the world, or if there are actual moneyed interest groups lined up against your efforts? If there is some cabal of, if it's like in America with the old line that the Firestone and General Motors and the motor car companies destroyed the streetcar system. Is there something like that lined up against your efforts, or do you think it's cultural inertia or just something else where you've sort of shown up in a neighborhood where people do things a certain way and they don't like the change? I was wondering who your biggest opponents were, and I was wondering if you could start with Kyle in Memphis, and if Roger, if you could answer next. These are the two bike coordinators, Kyle, the bike coordinator in Memphis, and Roger Geller, the bike coordinator in Portland. Kyle, if you're still with us.
Yeah, talking about sort of what the opposition is in Memphis, we've been the beneficiary of learning from all the cities that came before us and their struggles. And so while early on we initially had some opposition from business leaders, particularly small localized businesses that were concerned about how traffic patterns on the streets might be changed as a result of adding bicycle lanes or removing parking or removing travel lanes, we've largely sort of moved beyond that in much of our public discussion. And so we went into these places, had the public dialogue about what the changes might entail. We put the bike lanes in some cases, despite opposition still being present. And the truth of the matter is, that the bike lanes did not bring upon the apocalypse to our business corridors, and businesses did not shut down. In fact, the exact opposite is happening on many of our corridors throughout the city. And so for the last year and a half, last 2 years or so, we've been fairly controversy-free on many of the new implementations that's going wrong. I think you know, in general terms, I think what you mentioned about cultural inertia is probably the biggest thing that we battle. Just the mere fact that somebody could wake up one day and the street operates a little bit differently than what it was when they went to bed is sort of an unsettling thing for folks. And I think Zach mentioned earlier that, you know, traffic, for whatever reason, is a very emotional experience for people. And how the streets is designed is very emotional. It sometimes brings out some very visceral responses. But for the most part, we don't recognize or acknowledge, you know, any kind of formalized movement to rid the streets of bike lanes here in Memphis. And in fact, we're finding that the popularity and momentum is quite the opposite of that. People are demanding more. We're having trouble keeping up with the demands to add new facilities here in the city.
Huh. And Roger, in Portland, have you found that there is an organized opposition, or is it quite the opposite?
Yeah, no, there is really no organized opposition. I agree with what Kyle said. We recently had one of our principal civic organizations, the City Club of Portland, do a report on what the future of bicycling should be in Portland. So that was the essential question that they answered, that they addressed, was what should be the future of bicycling in Portland? And it was a year-long process for them. They went out and interviewed a lot of people who are interested in bicycling, and they made a concerted effort to find any kind of organized opposition to bicycling. And they were really seeking it out. They were beating the bushes. They were looking under the cushions. They couldn't find any organized opposition to bicycling in the city. The opposition that does occur does generally tend to be localized. It is at the project level. So, you know, like Tip O'Neill used to say, all politics is local. So when we're going out onto somebody's street and talking about removing parking, that's when the opposition arises. And then it's incumbent upon us as the people proposing the project to really talk about how it's going to work, what the benefits are going to be. So the opposition does tend to be really localized. You know, there, I think that it is more cultural inertia and fear of change, that there are vested interests, people who are vested in businesses, business people, organizations that represent businesses, who are wary about change that may alter the traffic pattern in their commercial district, that may make it more difficult in their minds for freight vehicles to move along the roadways. And so they have concerns, and, you know, it's inertia. It's, you know, things are working well now. Let's not change anything. But I think we have been successfully overcoming that and are, like Garrick said, we are winning allies in the business community to the idea of bicycling, especially in the small business community, where over 100 small businesses in the city of Portland have asked us to remove on-street car parking and replace it with on-street bicycle parking.
All right.
So we've
hey.
Done that at 100 locations and growing, all at the request of adjacent businesses and business districts.
So, again, it seems like a problem of sort of playing catch-up, actually, with people in favor of it once they see the positive effects. That's great to hear. Hopefully some of this will trickle down to some of the other cities in America and around the world. Thank you, gentlemen, so much for your time. I'm going to pass it back over to Nick Richard, my partner here in the studio.
Well, actually, I wanted to ask, it seems like we've got different levels here. We've got Joseph, who's just a small bike shop owner. He's like one guy. And then we have all of these you know, bike advocacy organizations. And then we have the Green Lanes Project, and then we have the European Cycling Federation. And so one of the questions that I wanted to ask all the participants here is there a difference in getting bike lanes installed in the U.S. and in Europe? Like, is it easier in Europe, I guess, is the question.
Shall I give you a European... that's on the assumption that Europe is some kind of homogenous place where one decision gets made. I think that somebody said it earlier on, all transportation is local. So, you know, we can see, you know, you can see almost like daft decisions made occasionally in the Netherlands because some local council official just forgot to understand. And, you know, you have cities in the towns in the east of the Netherlands
that have a bicycling share of about 7 or 8%. Now, I'm sure you guys would love 7 or 8%, but they just don't get it to the same extent as countries, for example, as the cities in, say, the north and the east, where they're at 30%. And for us, our great battlegrounds are actually the south and the east of Europe, where, you know, there are plenty of countries where our mode share is 1%, and it is just as tough to get it through, and we have to do the same knowledge transfer that Zach and the Green Lane Project are doing, bringing European stuff to the U.S. and helping the storytelling move around the U.S. So there isn't this kind of universal pan. What I think there is a tipping point. I think when you get, we think it's around 5%, we think it's kind of higher, but then there is an acceptability that this is mainstream. And while you're at 1, 2%, you're still effectively catering for an outlier group, and your mad editor in your local newspaper can believe that he's speaking for the majority. But the tipping point is actually quite low. At about 5, 6%, and you suddenly see cities go to 10% mode share, and you see bike businesses doing well, and you hear the things that kind of Roger described, others described about businesses wanting bicycling to come, and it's tipping point that I think is the key. And so we see those shifts occurring country by country, city by city, street by street, when the local politicians suddenly go, actually, this is a good thing. I think I'll support it.
Zach, do you want to tell us about the Green Lanes project a little more?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, Kevin, it's worth repeating because it's so important. You know, 80% of Europe is a lousy place to ride a bike. You know, when Americans think about European cycling, what they're really thinking about is a very small part of Europe, in Northern Europe, in the Netherlands and Denmark, parts of Germany and Scandinavia. And that's what we look to for models. But really, a lot of other European cities are on a very similar trajectory as American cities. And they're improving, and they're doing great things. And they're capitalizing on this same international momentum that our cities are. And it's really a combination of a couple things. It's bike share is one of these wonderful ideas that is spreading like wildfire throughout the world. It's also an area where American cities are ahead of Copenhagen and the Netherlands. And then the other idea is protected bike lanes, you know, better bike lanes that offer a much greater sense of security and invite a lot more different kinds of people to use them. It's an idea that's spreading through a lot of different places. So I would say, you know, comparing how things work in Europe to how things work in America, we're actually, I think, compared to a lot of European places, out ahead a little bit, especially in our leading cities like Chicago and Portland and Memphis.
But can you just tell us about the Green Lanes project? Like, I don't know if we got that out there in this talk.
You've got six cities. Yeah, so the Green Lane Project, it's a campaign of People for Bikes, which is a large national movement, and it is focused on pushing a particular innovation, which is the protected bike lane. And this is a bike lane that is on the street. It's separate from cars. It's separate from sidewalks, but it has some kind of a physical barrier between moving cars and people on bikes. And the reason why that is important is because when you ask people why don't they ride a bike more, the number one answer you get, no matter how you ask them or where you ask them, is that they just don't feel safe. 5 inches of white paint on the street is just not enough to make them feel comfortable to get out on there on the bike with their kids, with their groceries, for whatever reason. And this type of bike lane addresses that for a lot of people. It's the missing tool in American cities for your big, busy streets, the kind of streets where it just doesn't feel safe to be out there with cars for a lot of people. So that's what we're focused on, and we're helping American cities build these because we want to have more of them on the ground. We want to study them. We want to talk about them. We want to have more examples to show. And it's a partnership with the local groups like Ethan's group, Active Transportation Alliance, and Garrick's group, the BTA, businesses, and political leaders to make these happen better and faster.
You know, and this is Ethan from Chicago, and just speaking as a, you know, a group that's participating in the Green Lane Project, it's very beneficial for us that our Department of Transportation leaders are involved in the Green Lane Project and are coordinating with folks on this call in Memphis and in Portland who are doing the same work, and that we're able to connect with the advocacy organizations in those same cities. And for us, we're given the opportunity, our leaders have been able to go to Copenhagen and coordinate and meet and study, and there's a flow of information back and forth. And, you know, when we have an issue like, oh, you know, the media is saying this and people just don't like change, what did you learn, Memphis, and what are you hearing, Portland? And, you know, we get ideas from each other and messages and approach. So, as we've been pushing to get these protected bike lanes, and it's been helpful to have that support network of other cities and other transportation leaders that are all working towards this Green Lanes project goal.
There's a lot of conversations coming out of this, which are instructing a lot of people.
One other thing I need to mention about the Green Lane project is that we work with cities for a 2-year period, and our first 2-year campaign started in 2012. We are going to be choosing 6 new cities to work with in early 2014. And we would encourage all kinds of cities to apply, big, small, no matter where they are in terms of their bicycling progression. But what we are looking for is evidence of what we kind of call the triad of support. We want to see really strong political will. We want to see strong support from the business community. And then we want to see really great community groups like BTA and Active Trans that are willing to implement ambitious plans. So greenlaneproject2.org is the home for the application process for the next round of 6 cities.
All right, gentlemen, so we've gotten some great information from all of you. I'm going to do some Googling after this and see if I can track down some of this community cycling center survey from 2009 would be one example, and we're going to try and post that as a link along with this show when it goes live. I want to thank you guys so much for joining us today. I did have one question, coaster brake or freewheel, your preference. If we could start with Roger Geller at the top, coaster brake or freewheel on your bike?
It depends where I'm riding.
All right, good question.
Flat, I love the single-speed coaster brakes that I rode throughout the Netherlands. Very fun.
Kevin from the European Cycling Federation?
Definitely freewheel.
Freewheel all the way. All right. Hopefully that's freewheel with brakes. Ethan with the Active Transit Alliance in Chicago?
Yeah, definitely freewheel with brakes.
All right. And then Zach Vanderkooy in the Green Lanes Project?
Freewheel.
Freewheel. Oh, man, what's going on? My coaster brake's getting hammered here, guys. And Garrick with the BTA in Portland?
I'll take a coaster brake in Europe, but it's freewheel with brakes.
All right. And Kyle, the bike coordinator in Memphis, Mr. Wagenschutz?
Freewheel with brakes here in Memphis.
Oh, man. All right. Well, that just shows you the advocacy efforts. We've got to get that coaster brake going strong, guys. It's the only bike that you can ride and still turn with no hands on the handlebars. That's the key part there. You can come to a dead stop. Anyway, enough of my ridiculousness. Thank you both. Thank you all so much for being with us today. I'll hand it back to Nick, and I think that'll do it.
No, just thank you, everybody, for calling in. That was great, and I hope we could do it again sometime.
Great, thanks. That was fun.
Thank you.
All right, bye, guys. Wow, we got some hold music there. Well, let's talk over this hold music, Joseph. Thanks for coming in.
I tried to, maintain a slight air of ridiculousness at all times.
No, that loosens people up, I think. I think they enjoyed it.
I'm still hurt that nobody likes coaster brakes that much, but we'll work on that. That's part of that's going to be my next advocacy project, I think.
Did you really think that there would be a big coaster brake faction?
No. It takes a pretty dedicated, irresponsible cyclist to be into coaster brakes, but I'm glad to hear that we got some traction there in Portland. From Mr. Geller, the bike coordinator.
Yeah, we got a couple.
I have to say this. I really was surprised. This was quite a useful conversation. I was here in this quiet studio. I was thinking, I'm going to fall asleep. It's so early. But no, there's some great information. In particular, the slants to some of these. There's some great studies to look up. I really like the measurements. I'm glad I asked about that. We got some great input from the European Cycling Federation about the quality of life. And I think I'm going to be interested in Los Angeles in particular, asking people how they feel about the roads. Maybe we've got to try and find a way for the mayor of LA or our local neighborhood councils to get involved in something of a qualitative quality of life survey. I know every year in the city of LA we do a the mayor has a survey of the city and says, well, how should I spend the money in the budget? And it's a very much like a push-pull. He breaks things down into categories, and it never really gets to the heart of how people experience the city, which I feel is kind of like the mayor's job is to find out how people are feeling about the city, and then he will take that input in and find a way to do it, as opposed to saying, well, hey everybody, how do I do my job? Well, I don't know, man. I'm not the mayor. I don't have all the advisors. I think a quality of life survey with regards to cycling, which city management in general might be a great way to spend whatever limited funding these cities have.
Well, I've asked the mayor to be on the show. He Eric Garcetti, as a councilman, made a trip out to do a Bike Talk episode.
Well, you guys were in his district, right? Kill Radio is in his district. No.
Yeah, you know what? I think it was, yeah.
All right, we got to find – well, now the whole city is his district.
Right. He's into what? Yeah, what do you think of the mayor as far as bikes?
I think Mayor Eric Garcetti is well positioned to pick up the mantle from where Mayor Villaraigosa left off and basically continue on what is going to be a massive sea change in the way Los Angeles designs its roadways. We've gotten a great start with our first pedestrian coordinator, I think, in the city's history. The DOT is just beginning to throw off the shackles of the 20th century road designing paradigm. We've got a whole host of new, fresh-faced, young 30-year-old men working in the department that are all, they grew up going on bike rides here in Los Angeles County with the Midnight Riders and other groups like that. And they work for the DOT in their bike division. I think the big problems we're going to face, especially with Mayor Garcetti, is that he is facing, and this is true, I think, for most mayors in American cities, both big and small. We have built a street system and a network of infrastructure that is unmaintainable. It doesn't generate enough revenue to cover its own maintenance. And so he's going to be struggling to talk to our international bond buyers, municipal bond buyers, and also the locals to find out how we are going to depave parts of the city and still maintain a quality of life, to reduce the supports we provide for the current way of life and kind of find a way to a quality of life that we can all agree is okay and afford. And I think that cycling is going to be a big part of that, but I don't think it's really clear in the politics. You might have heard some of the rhetoric with Kevin James during the mayoral campaign talking about the state of our city's finances. Unfortunately, most of these solutions coming from that side of the political spectrum, he's sort of more the conservative libertarian side, they're not really solutions in the 21st century sense. They're really in the 1950s solutions kind of repackaged with the great rhetoric that I think is pointing in the right direction. So I think he's got his hands full. I think cyclists in LA would do well to start focusing more on these quality of life issues. I was really struck by that, actually. It really hit me when I heard that it come up. It seemed like, wow, how I've been so blind to that. I've been focusing on these crashes. Let's focus on the positive side.
Yeah, because if you increase the larger number of people riding, then the number of people crashing is a smaller percentage.
I think that there's – in America in general, there is a lack of a data-centric focus on – like the gentleman from the European Cycling Federation brought up a great point, which is that let's look at these neighborhoods, not rich or poor, but let's look at these neighborhoods and say, what can we do here? Let's find that low-hanging fruit neighborhood, part of the city, where if we make this connection, now we have 500 or 1,000 more cyclists. That's something that is totally divorced from the conversations we're having here, because we don't have any hard numbers on cycling rates. I know in Los Angeles and in most other cities that I've read about, I do a lot of reading about urban planning, people study automobile counts, but we never have a clear picture on what's called modes share or mode split. We sort of have these general census level terms like, oh, only 1% of people ride bikes. But we never really have someone out there making sure that that's true or not. And I know I've seen an increase in my neighborhood when I'm riding and walking around Northeast Los Angeles. Just this morning, I can't think of a time when I've seen more cyclists on the road. It was really quite surprising. Every intersection, I'm seeing 2, 3, 4 people, whereas before it would just be me 5, 6 years ago. And I don't see there's any real hard data from either the advocacy organizations, the international groups. There's no money put into it. But just understanding that is going to help us get a hand on it. I think it'd be another great place to focus our attentions and maybe ask in Los Angeles that the mayor's office spearhead these a quality of life survey and help. I know the LA County Bike Coalition is doing a bike count, and it would be great if the data from the city's automated traffic signal and control system, it's called ATSAC. The city of LA has this automated traffic control system where they're collecting millions of data points a day on traffic, and then they delete it. They throw it all away, and it's a real tragedy. We don't know what the impact is of so many of the changes we're making in our streets on one day natural experiments in construction when a lane is reduced. And we don't know what it is because we're just throwing that data away. We're not looking at it. And so we need to start collecting more data and looking at it. And I think that'll really help drive things forward, because how do you know whether the rate of cycling has gone up if you're not even counting the number of bike riders? So, and that's kind of the case in LA.
You know, I had one question something that someone brought up, I think it was Zach from the Green Lanes Project, bike share, the U.S. is ahead of the Netherlands. Do you know what that means?
Well, I mean, I was a little bit surprised there that the U.S. was kicking butt on bike share. I think that when it comes to bike share, maybe we're ideally positioned, seeing as how we're sort of coming at this whole bike thing fresh after going so car-oriented. Maybe in Europe they've got a bit more to deal with in the public right-of-way in terms of financing. Maybe they have more, you know, bikes in the city centers already, and people can't, the corporations that are sponsoring and the health insurance companies like Kaiser that it would sponsor a bike share see it as more valuable here in the States. Whereas in Europe, maybe they have problems convincing people that, you know, it's worth subsidizing or it's worth writing off. Although when you're in Paris, the Vélib is advertisers supported. And in New York, I think it's also advertising supported. I think City Bikes, right? Citibank is sponsoring that.
Right.
But nonetheless, I was really taken aback. Although in Netherlands, they do have a very, very high number of bikes per person. And actually, bike sales there are quite low. A lot of the local shops have razor-thin margins. I mean, like 2% of a margin that they're living off of. And it's shrinking. So there's more consolidation going on in the Netherlands, which is just like with cycling, it seems like a bit of a special case with the bike business as well. There, they're seeing a big bump in e-bikes. And I think in the States, we haven't yet realized that. They're a bit ahead of the curve with respect to that kind of thing.
And I'd like to do this again. Would you come back as a moderator if we did this again?
Yeah, this was a very transit accessible station. The building outside is a bit of a brick monolith, but getting here by train was great. I took the Gold Line. I had a little folding bike I stole from my shop. I took the Gold Line to the Red Line and just basically sat and smelled other people's body odor for a little while. It's great, yeah. Instead of just smelling my own, you know, in the bike shop. So, no, it was a really nice ride, and I'd be happy to, yeah.
All right, then let's try to think about what the next show is going to be about.
Maybe just popping wheelies, techniques, bunny hopping,
coaster brakes,
skids.
but with a global focus.
Right. Yeah, totally. To be developed.
All right. Thanks, Joseph. And you got your shop, Flying Pigeon, in Highland Park.
Yeah, yeah. It's Highland Park, Cypress Park neighborhood of North East Los Angeles, and we specialize in European-style city bikes and also just we do 3 monthly rides. Get people riding out in the city, do a brewery ride, art gallery tour, and to get some dim sum brunch ride. I'm very excited about that. So kind of try to make ourselves a little community hub. But right. Yeah, thanks again, Nick. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Joseph.